Hi, I'm David Manti, and welcome to a new episode of the Today in Manufacturing podcast. With me this week are Jeff Branke and Anna Wells. We each have more than 15 years of experience covering the manufacturing industry. Every week, we take the five most popular stories on our websites and discuss the implications they have on the industry going forward. But before we get started, please make sure to like, share, and subscribe to the podcast. You could also help us out a lot by leaving us a positive review on whatever platform you use. If you want to email the podcast, you can reach any of us at Jeff, David, or Anna at IN.com with email the podcast in the subject line. You could also subscribe to our newsletter. Make sure you get it delivered to your inbox first. And subscribe to us on YouTube at IN Magazine so you can join us live every Thursday when we go live on YouTube. Jeff, how are you doing this week?
Great, David. How about yourself?
Good. It was, a bit of a race to get in here on time, but you set a time and you stick to it.
Did you just say that out loud?
Yeah, do you?
Oh, man, I'm like, is that like on the record now?
Now you have to.
No!
That feels weird.
Oh, no. Now
that feels weird that you would say that out loud.
Yeah. I mean, but I mean it this time. Anna, how are you doing?
Yeah, I agree. It was a little bit of a scramble. Usually the video guys are like, when do you guys want to start the podcast? And then we're like, when we tell you. And then this week they were like, get in the studio right now. It's starting.
And
we're
like, yeah, they're like, it's starting in 5 minutes. And I'm like, all right.
Okay.
Yeah, I guess.
What's it about?
I'll be there.
No. We don't know yet.
Yeah, we'll figure it out as we go. Today, our top story is manufacturing. Is it? No. All right. Before we jump into our first story this week, we have a word from our sponsor. To build a scalable maintenance function in today's market, organizations need to drive increased output from their equipment and their facilities with fewer resources. But there's one problem. Maintenance 1.0 needs to evolve. Get on board, Maintenance 1.0. Let's get with the program. Join us Thursday, January 25th. That's today. We just did it. So join us on demand for building your 24 maintenance program, 4 key principles to boost uptime now and for the future. So did this go well? It went well. Learn which maintenance strategies you can leverage to boost uptime and why software, data, and technology are essential to the future of maintenance. I mean, we said we did run in here, but I could have changed that.
Sounds like you need to attend.
Yeah, no, it's a
webinar.
So. Yeah, it's definitely an on-demand webinar now. Mm-hmm. So click the link below and we'll send it to you on demand. Or check out the next one. All right, our first story this week. Let's pick up the pieces and put it together. MIT tests hydrogen-powered motorcycle. The world still seems a little unsure when it comes to battery-powered vehicles. Is there a better path? A greener path to the future of transportation? The electric vehicle team at MIT certainly thinks so, and they think hydrogen-powered vehicles could be a cleaner alternative. The team is building a hydrogen-powered electric motorcycle that uses a fuel cell system. The open-source platform will serve as a testbed for new hydrogen-based transportation. The team is made up of about a dozen students who have been working on building the prototype since January 2023. They are modifying a 25-year-old motorcycle with several custom parts to support the electric motor, hydrogen tank, fuel cell, and drivetrain. The motorcycle took shape last year as industry sponsors donated components for the system. Most importantly, the team had to use battery power during development until South Korean company Doosan donated a fuel cell. Until now, the few prototypes previously developed were inefficient and expensive, and much of the work was simulated. However, while hydrogen is mostly affordable for research, it's not reasonable for commercial production. The fuel cell remains a big, expensive part of it. Initial tests for the motorcycle were held on a dynamometer, and last October, the team successfully tested this motorcycle on a test track for the first time. The team hopes the project and those building off its foundation will accelerate demand for hydrogen vehicles and push infrastructure investment. Anna, will it?
No.
Next topic. No, Anna, it seems like we've made this transition, right? Where we made the decision, EV, battery-powered EVs was the way forward, hybrids and hydrogen left in the dust, And all of a sudden, we're seeing this complete resurgence of hydrogen-powered vehicles.
I don't know if I'd say resurgence.
Or, yeah.
I mean,
resurfacing, maybe.
Maybe just like niche research projects and stuff. I don't know. You know, it's a neat concept. I think hydrogen is very cool. I think the fuel cell concept is great. But to be sure, like, it doesn't solve range anxiety. Like, yeah. You know, range anxiety is just another phrase applied to the problem of a lack of public infrastructure, which hydrogen also does not have. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. To me, it's like, I feel like we talk about like that it's a deal killer for electrics, but with hydrogen, it's like, well, yeah, I mean, we do need infrastructure, but
I think it's weird because it's like when they say, I think it fixes part of the anxiety, not range anxiety, when they say it's filled just like a gas filled car.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, that just like rounds the edges a little bit.
Not for me, because there is no such thing as a hydrogen refueling station.
People don't need to think that far. They're just like, oh, just like gas filled stations.
I don't think that's true. I think, you know, I think there's some benefit in exploring this. Like, you know, obviously hedging our bets a little bit on electric, you know, may be valuable, but the infrastructure piece is huge. So is the cost, as you mentioned. And unfortunately, for hydrogen, electrics just have a big advantage already in terms of addressing both of these things, because they have a head start in terms of development and also emerging market acceptance at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I just think, like, you know, all this dev is taking place during what for electric vehicles is really an execution phase. Hopefully we can do this too, maybe down the road if it's needed. But like, yeah. I think we could also offer a better sales pitch than why not? They asked them why they were doing it and they said, why not? You know, I think you need to offer some better evidence than that of the need for it. Because I think right now, like, observers of this and the hydrogen concept say things like, the public is not incentivized to care about hydrogen because they don't have to at this point. Like, yeah. Already, like, they feel like electric vehicles are solving the problem that needs to be solved, which is getting rid of gas. And so why? You know, why add this to the mix? Why invest billions and billions of dollars into further infrastructure if that's what would need to take place, which it would? Scale, which would take a lot of time and a lot of investment to get that price point down. So I don't think there's a reason at this point for consumers to care enough to get this off the ground. So projects like this, while they're cool and they're, you know, the research is interesting, I don't know that they prove that point.
Yeah. I guess there is something to say about just because you can doesn't mean you should. But we did receive a lot of feedback where people were championing this because it was at a university level, where it's like, okay, this is great to see. Maybe, maybe not. Let the kids figure it out. And maybe if they stumble on something, maybe we might really have something.
Yeah. I'm not saying like leave it in the dust, bury it in the ground. Like, you know, continue to research this stuff if you want. And if they can find ways to make it more viable long term, great. I mean, we're going to need lots of solutions, I think, especially as we get to the point with batteries where maybe it's not workable to continue to mine to build batteries for electric vehicles. Maybe there needs to be another thing to kind of hedge that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think right now there are a lot of barriers and not a ton of like clamoring within the market for people to say, give me another option. You know?
Right. Jeff, I typically, when I think of like a potential good application for hydrogen powered vehicles, I think of something with like a closed circuit fleet, like mining heavy off-road equipment, right? But we've seen recent applications. We've seen like major like work at Caterpillar and other major manufacturers where they're making battery powered heavy off-road equipment. And I mean, has the ship sailed for an applicability there as well? I mean, should we just leave hydrogen behind, or, you know, should we continue to develop?
Yeah. I mean, obviously we need to continue to develop. You need all sorts of different applications and different answers. The thing here is, circling back a little bit to what you're talking about, when it comes to hydrogen, one of the reasons that people will push for it from an infrastructure perspective is you can pressurize a gas. So in other words, when you're filling up, it can take literally a minute. Okay.
Yeah.
So it's much quicker that way, as opposed to sitting at a charging station for, even in an optimal situation, 15 to 20 minutes. Okay. And even for a fast charger.
And you can move it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
you can transport electricity as well.
But just like, I think logistically, when you think about our existing infrastructure, it makes more sense that way too.
But then, we've kind of gone full circle. We've talked about how difficult and how intensive and unenvironmentally inviting hydrogen production is.
Yeah.
So again, getting back to where the benefits are, I think it is great to have these types of projects and have them get notoriety and fund them and research them and all that, but not with a wide-reaching goal in mind. Mm-hmm. It's never going to take the place of EVs. We've looked at this in a lot of different ways. And from an infrastructure perspective, again, just to develop an EV charging station, and again, the numbers are going to fluctuate. So I'll just say it this way. You're looking at tens of thousands of dollars to create an EV charging station. Mm-hmm. To create a hydrogen filling station, you're looking at millions of dollars.
That's a good point.
When you put it in that context, you can see we've picked the winner here already.
Yeah.
But I agree with you 100%. When you're looking at sort of on-campus type of fleets, mm-hmm. if you're looking at a chemical facility that either buys a lot of hydrogen to use within sort of their recipe, if you will, for whatever they're creating, or it's created as a byproduct, mm-hmm. it makes a ton of sense to have these vehicles on premise to use them, whether it's for material handling, material transportation, whatever the case may be. I mean, some of these facilities are legitimately small cities.
Oh, yeah.
So to have a fleet of vehicles that uses this type of technology, which we already know about. I mean, hydrogen fuel cells have been around for over 100 years, okay? So we know how all the good stuff about it and how well it can work. It's just not, as Anna was saying, it's not scalable, and I don't think it ever will be.
Yeah. One of the things that I was really drawn to about this project and all projects that are open source is that they're doing it open source and they're creating like a textbook, a guidebook as to how they did it, why they did it, and how other people could maybe do it differently. So I do like the idea of kind of opening it up to other research teams that might have a little bit of availability to kind of play around with it a little bit, you know? Yeah. We saw how open source has affected leaps and bounds when it comes to like coding, leaps and bounds when it comes to additive manufacturing, hardware and software. So I think the power of being open source, again, could really help people build off of this project. I don't know. Absolutely. In general, I like the idea of an open source project. The team says that they made it open source so they could swap out and test various components. And like I said, let other groups and individuals kind of build their own versions. And if it's at a base level, if it goes no further than the academic level, and you just have teams of researchers making really cool hydrogen powered bikes, I still think that's a win. You know, I mean, that's a win for the STEM community, period. I also think that it shines a light on the opportunity for industrial or industry sponsorships. I understand that most of them are misses, but just imagine if your tech is involved in some sort of breakthrough, like in this particular example, hydrogen vehicle that completely upends the EV industry. Unlikely, but I understand that sometimes people look at industry sponsorship opportunities and they just think maybe it's a marketing cost or maybe it's just throwing away money. But I do think there's real value there in terms of name recognition, especially something at the academic level and getting kind of your brand in front of these future engineers and designers. But I don't know. I think there's a real opportunity there. Anna, what do you think about industry sponsorships?
If it makes sense to these companies, I know that they have a lot happening in terms of like technology that exists today, you know, so it's hard to know like how they would make those selections, but certainly an opportunity.
Yeah. I mean, we're not always talking about like the fuel cell, you know, mm-hmm. like there are all kinds of other components that these projects are looking for. And I mean, sometimes it comes down to the O-rings they're going to use.
I feel like you have your pitch deck ready. Like mm-hmm. you were leading yep. into that, like you were setting up to the fact. And because of that, you should really think about sponsoring David's AI 401k platform.
Yeah,
so AI 401k.
Yeah. Everything I do is
sponsor
in this
David's,
little box.
Like, sponsor David's 401k.
Sponsor, you know what?
Sponsor my 401k. I'm in on this.
I'll just like sponsor like a babysitter fund. Like we'll just call it David and Anna's like a little mental health fund, you know? Goes to babysitters, high quality, perhaps a nanny. No, John Dearden, who's watching us live. It's always good to hear from you, John. He says, electric is going to die on its own in America. Coming out swinging. Hydrogen using a modified internal combustion engine would be easy. Steam only exhaust. Why use a fuel cell? It doesn't buy you anything, does it? I mean, oh, Jack is watching us live too. Jack, good to hear from you. And you're right. He says hi to the team. Hi, Jack. It makes you wonder what unforeseen problems might be out there. Granted. Similar to the battery issue with electric cars, it's already known production of hydrogen uses and it uses non-renewable resources. As Jeff pointed out, like, yes, none of these, nothing's perfect. Nothing's perfect. I think that's one thing we can agree on, right?
That is genius insight, David.
Genius insight. We're going to pick a winner and we're going to take some losses on whatever we pick. All right. Our next most popular story this week. That was like high quality analysis.
It's like when we do a safety story, you're like, Jeff, that's bad.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no bad. Disagreeing with that. That is, you're 100% accurate. Yeah.
I'm waiting for the time where you're like, you know what? No, it's good that he lost a finger. It was a teachable moment. All right. Our next most popular story. Helmet manufacturer says Mahomes' shattered lid in playoff game, quote, did its job. Many panicked, gasped, or at least looked at social media later after Chiefs quarterback Patrick Mahomes shattered his helmet during an AFC wildcard game against the Miami Dolphins. The speculation piled up. Was it a manufacturing defect? Should the NFL be concerned? According to Serator Sports, which makes the Visus 02, that's the helmet Mahomes was wearing, he says that the helmet did its job. The game was played in unprecedented cold temperatures, the fourth coldest in NFL history. The temperature at kickoff was -4 degrees Fahrenheit. The wind chill, -30. The company said such extreme conditions are bound to test the limits of even the highest performing products. The extreme cold made the helmet's outer shell brittle, which caused the large chunk to fly when Mahomes was hit. The 02 uses a proprietary multi-layer technology that creates a deformable outer shell that is wrapped around a stiffer inner shell. The design is similar to car bumpers, which are engineered to absorb and disperse energy at the point of impact. While the helmet was sent away to be tested, Mahomes wants to make sure that he gets it back because, quote, it's something that's cool. Anna, that is kind of an interesting take for somebody whose protection for his head shattered in the heat of the moment. But at the end of the day, it was a very violent play and it looked really bad. But it worked as expected, and hopefully this technology can continue to progress so that way maybe it's available to a few more people.
Yeah. The article that we ran on our site, you didn't really get into this part of it, but it did show, I think it did a good job of kind of showing a case study of how these startups can easily get buried by big competitors.
Yeah.
Because it talked about how... this company, Visus, is that what how you say it?
Yeah, so you say Visus. And I mean, you're right. It was founded in 2017. Mm-hmm. It was very popular. Raised $85 million with Aaron Rodgers, Russell Wilson, Jerry Rice. But to your point, the company really struggled to compete with Riddell, and I think it's shut.
Yeah, but these companies that were kind of already embedded in the market, even though, you know, who knows, maybe this was a superior product. I mean, this is certainly an interesting, maybe evidence of how well it functions. But they came very close to not making it. And I think had it not been for some of those high profile investors, maybe this would have just faded into the night. Hard to know. But I do think that, you know, this technology around helmets is exciting. We've run a bunch of stories over the last couple of years about some of these big manufacturers. And then of course also Visus trying to modify their designs and make these really reflect some of the data that has been generally accepted in the last few years around CTE, right? Mm-hmm. I think there was a long time that the NFL wasn't really acknowledging that. Now they are. There's really just overwhelming evidence of some of the risks that are surrounding concussions there. So, of course, to see this work as designed was pretty exciting and hopefully prevent this type of thing in the future. I think there's another distinct challenge here, though, and that is cost. Like the NFL obviously has endless budgets for equipment to protect their very valuable talent. You know, they're going to spend whatever it takes to do that for a Patrick Mahomes. Mm-hmm. But the path to the NFL obviously starts much, much earlier. And experts believe that even at younger ages, like high school and college level play of football, that kids are facing risks of head injury.
Oh, yeah.
And my guess that's true even earlier, but they probably just don't have data on it. Mm-hmm. So if you look at these helmets, they cost like $500 plus a piece. And they make you sizes and they're like $350. Mm-hmm. And that's nothing against Visus. They're, you know, they're a startup. It's new technology. I'm sure it's expensive to produce. But it's obviously out of reach for the average program. If yeah. you're, you know, if you're just playing high school football, they're not coming close to these. So, you know, you hope that maybe a high profile story like this will provide a boost to Visus, and maybe, help enhance their ability to scale this tech. Hopefully you'll see those costs go down in the future based on that. So, I mean, I was glad to see them call out. I think there was no way to not call it out because it was so visible when it happened. Everyone saw it. Yeah. Of course, they're going to talk about it. But to make sure that in the follow-up coverage, this company is called out and they're looking at you know, helmet technology and how it really does matter what you have on your head.
Yeah, they're like, Visus, did you see this? And they're like, yeah.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Just as expected. I mean, you talk about it. We talk about it as having kids that may or may not want to play football starting, and they start very young, very mm-hmm. young. I mean, maybe that could be one of the, you know, barriers to entry is it's just like, all right, yes, but you're going to need to use this helmet and you're going to have to earn, you're going to have to start mowing lawns
yeah.
to pay for this $350 helmet. And you're right. It does show a really interesting case study on technology born in a startup, but they like, we're pretty much bled dry. Like co-founder and CEO mm-hmm. Dave Marver resigned in November 2019. The company's board put it in receivership the following month. More than 100 employees were laid off just to try and avoid a bankruptcy.
Yeah.
And so Innovatus Capital Partners, who bought the assets of Visus in 2020, they're actually, they became Serator Sports. They make the Shoot brand of helmets. And one thing that I like to see is that they already had a brand of helmets, right? Like they probably could have bought the assets, stripped it for parts mm-hmm. and killed it. Maybe they saw a real opportunity here and decided to keep it on the market. And I know what you're thinking. It's crazy. He looked up how to pronounce Serator and Visus and he messed up brittle. But hey, we all know my personal failings.
Yeah, I would never ask that question. I would just be like, oh.
Yeah, there it is. There yeah. it is. Yeah. No one even knows the word that he said. Jeff.
You're really good at calling yourself out though.
I know. Yeah. Accept your failings and project them at a fraction of how you feel it inside. Jeff, did you see this play in real time?
I did not because I hate watching football on Amazon.
Oh, that's right. Aww. No, this was this a Peacock game? This is the controversial Peacock game where like only half as many people saw it.
Oh, I thought this one was on Amazon.
Oh, either way, redigress.
Peacock is fine. I hate watching football on Amazon. It's their user interface, whatever you want to call it, is horrible.
Yeah.
Like, so no, I did not watch it in real time. I watched the replay later on yeah. NFL Network where I could fast forward through.
Yeah. Well, and it's just like when you see it, it's, you know, helmet to helmet contact and a piece goes flying. It's understandable how a lot of people who don't really understand what they're looking at can get scared by something like that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think this whole situation, first of all, I want to go back to like a little bit of what Anna was saying about scaling up. I think the fact that both Shoot and this company have the same parent organization is mm-hmm. going to help with scale.
Oh, yeah.
Because Shoot is huge in hockey and they're far behind Riddell when it comes to the NFL. Okay. So I think this does give them an opportunity to sort of grow that market. Mm, so I think yeah. the acquisition was made with the intent of growing the Visus brand, which
well, and
better for everyone involved.
Probably a real opportunity in hockey as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that's interesting. I think what we're really seeing, and maybe it was different. I only played high school football, so I don't want to also like blow my experience out of proportion. But your helmet was just sort of part of your uniform. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, it was there. Obviously, it was inherent that it was there to protect you, but it wasn't reinforced as being a safety piece of gear. It was just like, yeah, that's your helmet. Just put the stickers on. You get your award stickers. You put it on there. You had to carry it everywhere. It was kind of a pain, all that kind of stuff. You always wanted to take it off when you're doing drills or whatever. So that's really shifted. So there's so much more focus now on the helmet. which is a good thing,
yeah.
which is a great thing, especially when you look back at sort of the evolution of the football helmet. I mean, we know what it used to be, how bad they were. Yeah. But really, there was a stretch from like the late 70s to the early 2000s. The football helmet did not really change that much. It was plastic. It was polycarbonate. They maybe put some more pads in there. They messed with the chin strap a little bit to make that better. But overall, it was not that different. And what we've seen in the last 20-ish years is really a focus on using all these new materials that we have, these new lighter weight polycarbonates that are more durable, that respond better to temperature, and actually kind of move with the player a little bit, the multi-layers, all that kind of stuff. Because, I mean, the helmet that I wore, even though it was exponentially better than maybe what my dad wore, still, when you hit something hard, I mean, the vibration alone, that you felt it through your entire body. So the fact that all this is going on, the fact that it should become more scalable and reaching out to make it more affordable to more high schools and grade schools and things like that, I think is a huge, huge improvement. And when you see people... regardless of how you feel about Aaron Rodgers around here or anything else, but that name recognition and what that brings to the table is also a big deal, along with just some of the stuff you're seeing now about playing heads up, seeing what you hit, all that kind of stuff.
No, I mean, on the point about how things have changed, I mean, I was taught that this is a weapon. Your head was a weapon once you put a helmet on it, and it wasn't any more calculated then there were three piles of helmets in the gym, and it was just you started with small, or maybe, you know, you knew where to start, and then there was like that pile way at the end. They had like five of the like triple XL helmets for those guys.
It was a big deal when they started pumping them up. They used to, they actually had an air bladder in them. That was like a newer thing when I started playing football, which it's hard to understand how that wasn't before.
It's weird that when you talk about hitting somebody with your head and like the shock that goes down your neck, shoulders, and back, and I like kind of get nostalgic about it. I'm just like, oh man, that was great. Made your body all warm, made you kind of confused. John Dearden, he says Formula One helmets cost $15,000, custom made for each head and carbon fiber. Why would the NFL use a $500 item when better must be available? And I think that $500 price point, that's like the consumer cost, right?
That's like,
that's off the shelf
online.
I'm sure Pat Mahomes has something a little bit more expensive than $500 on his dome.
Well, racing helmets, correct me if I'm wrong though too, John. I mean, you're talking about they've got air going in there. They've got audio going in there at a much different level than a quarterback does. I know they've got the speaker in there and they can talk to the coach.
Yeah.
But those racing helmets are, that's a different world.
But it is a good comparison of like, if you focused on helmet technology throughout the lifespan of the sport, where maybe it could have been, you know, in terms of... yeah. What an NFL helmet is. The Virginia Tech Helmet Lab has also done a lot of research on helmets. And cracking the helmet's shell actually has happened at the Virginia Tech Helmet Lab. So again, to insiders, it wasn't a surprise. To everybody else, you know, they were screaming, my baby, and taking their kids out of football. All right. Our next most popular story. Ford shifts workers, cuts F-150 Lightning production. Last week, Ford announced that it is scaling back production of the F-150 Lightning full-size electric pickup truck. Some 1,400 employees will be impacted when the Electric Vehicle Center in Dearborn, Michigan moves to just one shift at the beginning of April. However, Ford will also create nearly 900 new jobs on a new third crew at its Michigan assembly plant in Wayne to help scale production for the Bronco and the Bronco Raptor, as well as the new Ranger and Ranger Raptor. That new crew will also include about 700 people from Ford's Rouge complex in Dearborn who applied for job openings within the company. Ford is also offering a special retirement incentive program that it agreed to as part of the 2023 contract with the UAW. Now, Ford has warned that a few dozen employees could be impacted at components plants supporting the F-150 Lightning, but it promised to provide placements for impacted employees within southeastern Michigan. Ford still expects global EV sales to grow in 2024, but Jeff, it will be much less than anticipated. It's weird, just in a year's time, maybe even 6 months' time, the trajectory of the F-150 Lightning. From incredible sales, back orders that they can't meet, to disappointing. No worries, Doug. It's good to see you. He's sorry he's late, but hey, you know, we get here when we get here. It's crazy to see what happened in that 1 year's time with the Lightning. And now to see that, I mean, this is the second time in what, 2 months that they've scaled back production for the Lightning?
Yeah, but I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I don't think it's really, some sort of huge negative reflection on Ford or the Lightning itself. I think really what happened here is the F-150, which has been the number one selling vehicle for basically our entire lifetimes here in the U.S., it has incredible brand power and brand recognition. So when Ford says, hey, we're going to come up with an electric version, everybody was super excited about it. And yeah, that demand built up. Then they got it and they're like, you know, there's some stuff that we still need to work on here, like you would expect with any first generation product. Yeah. None of the deficiencies that people point out, number one, should be a surprise. Okay. Mm-hmm. The range is what it is. I mean, you had to know once you placed that order, you knew what the range was going to be. Mm-hmm. You also knew there's going to be limitations, you know, when it gets cold or when you're pulling something heavy.
Yeah.
That shouldn't be a surprise. But I think a lot of those who bought into the F-150, you know, brand and the mystique and everything that was coming on, their expectations were lowered or diminished because of what they got. They thought this was going to be some sort of super truck, and it's an electric truck, and it has a lot of cool bells and whistles, but it didn't match a lot of those expectations. And I think that is just, again, goes back to the brand power of the F-150 overall. I think some of the other things that are interesting in coming out of this story is, again, all of these, they're not meeting their demand, but they're still selling more than they have the year before. Okay, so yeah, their demand and their projections were off based on all this excitement and enthusiasm, but what they're selling is not a bad number. They're not doing poorly. It's just less than they anticipated.
Yeah.
So they have to do some shifts in workers, which I think is to be expected. The thing that I think was interesting too, when you look at what they're doing with these workers, I think you're seeing a little bit of onus being placed on the skill set of those who have worked on EVs before. I think in the past, maybe when we talk about rearranging shifts or moving people around, we're talking about job cuts. And it felt to me in reading the article that they were very careful about not doing that. They want to hold on to these folks. They'll send them wherever they can to keep them under the Ford banner.
Yeah,
I think that does place, again, some significance on what they were working on previously. And I'll eat some crow here, but I think you have to give the UAW and Sean Fain some credit here too, because if you start making job cuts, you start getting into those conversations after you just came out of a long negotiation and strike, and they probably didn't want to deal with that either.
Yeah.
So I think there was some interesting underlying currents to some of the stuff going on here.
So Ford sold just over 24,000 Lightnings last year. That was up 55% from 2022. But to your point a little bit, dealers are showing slower sales, rising inventories of the electric truck, which starts just under $50,000. That number seemed low to me. I thought it was much higher.
Well, and that was actually one of the things. I was reading the Motor Trend article, and when they first came out, they were talking about a $40,000 base model that went up to 50. So that kind of, you know, annoyed some folks a little bit. But it's like with any vehicle, I think especially trucks, when you start putting in some pretty, I don't know, standard features, what you would consider standard, right, but are not in the standard base model, that price goes up fast.
Yeah. And the production cuts come at an interesting time, right? Because right now, Detroit automakers and dealers, I think today, are protesting the Biden administration, saying that they're going too far with these new emission rules that they're kind of shooting for, saying that these are going to result in 67% of all new vehicles in 2032 being EVs. And Detroit automakers and the dealerships are saying, like, hey, that's just not going to happen. Do you think, like, jumping the gun too much with EVs and our expectations for them? Or is it a necessary push that we're giving them to make sure, you know, they get to market and survive?
I mean, yeah, that's a pretty big question, but I agree with a lot of what Jeff is saying. And my perspective on this story was also similar. This feels like some lumpiness around not just the EV trend rollout, but also the automotive industry in general. I mean, we've seen other automakers kind of make some conservative choices heading into the full calendar year of 24, knowing that the expectations are this is going to be a little bit of a lighter year. So I do think that EV adoption is going to see some bumps in the road, especially as automakers try to assess that accurate supply and demand. It's a totally different game from what they were doing before. And when it's a technology that the market isn't entirely used to, I think it's going to take some time for some people to warm up to it, and some never will, of course. Mm-hmm. But if I can use the Toyota Prius as an example, I was a writer for an automotive journal kind of around the time that the Prius was hitting the market and starting to be more mass produced. And I just want to remind everyone about how much crap Toyota took about how ugly the Prius was and how hybrids were a fad. And this was a time period, too, when gas prices were kind of starting to trend higher. So there was a reason for it, just as there is a reason for electrics now with our kind of climate crisis that we're staring down at this point. But for the first couple years that Prius was on the market, Toyota sold less than 20,000 annually. And that was really with no competition at all in that sector. No other hybrids, really. There were some performance hybrids on the market, but there were not really any that were out targeting just fuel efficiency alone. It took another 5 years before Toyota really started to hit their stride and peak with the Prius sales. And those continued to be pretty steady for like another decade after that. It wasn't really until a couple of years ago that those started to slow. And I think that was because it was old. There's a lot more competition now. Suddenly hybrids, plug-ins, electrics, everything on the scene to compete. But my point here is that growing a market for new tech is complicated.
Painful, yeah.
Yeah. And I think we're kind of in new territory here when you consider that every automaker is now dumping a bunch of brand new electrics on the market at the exact same time. Like that is a variable that the automakers need to kind of fumble through, I think, you know?
No, that's a good way of putting it, actually, yeah.
So I know that the comments on the article went straight to whether auto was truly giving people what they want, to your point. And that's fair, of course, but I don't think that that speaks to the lack of viability of pure electrics. I think it speaks to the unevenness of...
The lumpiness.
It is. I mean, it's a really strange territory, and I think there's going to be some clumsiness, for lack of a better word, as automakers work through this. That just makes sense. And you know, one last thing. So last week, Toyota CEO said that he predicted that EVs would max out at 30% market share. That's what he thinks that they're going to reach. I think that that's low. Mm-hmm. I think partly to justify some of Toyota's hydrogen and hybrid efforts, maybe. But even at 30%, there is a lot of room to grow. I mean, right now we're at 7.5%. So again, it's not an issue of EVs aren't working. It's an issue of how do EVs work in this market and mm-hmm. trying to figure that out as we go.
Well, maybe 30% is just the next milestone, right?
Maybe.
And
I don't know.
And I mean, honestly, Toyota... I don't know if they're like the ones to be the authority on EV predicting.
They have one pure electric on the U.S. market that they've had a couple recalls on already. I don't think they're really killing it out there yet. So, I mean, it makes sense that he would say that, I guess. Yeah. But yeah, I don't know if I agree.
Well, they hedged. They were heavily invested in hybrid technology. And I think they had some hydrogen going on too, right?
They're one of the more leading OEMs when it comes to definitely the hydrogen developments. Mm-hmm. They put a lot of eggs in that cart. Yeah. Is that the saying?
Basket.
Eggs in that basket.
Basket?
I mean, if you put eggs in a cart.
They might fall through.
Yeah. Like the casters on carts these days are just going to rattle those open.
Yeah.
John was asking, you know, they had already cut back to 1,600 electric trucks a day. And that was the December announcement.
Yeah.
So does that mean... they're cutting that again? Because this announcement came out 2 days ago. This was
okay, but there's a different way to look at that cut. Yeah. When you have a line, because I think I saw the same article, when you have a line that can produce up to 3,200 a day and you start doing 1,600, are you making a cut or are you just adjusting to demand? I mean, you can look at that either way. I understand. You could say they cut it back from what they're capable of doing.
Yeah.
But to Anna's point, and I think she said it well, you do want to be a little clumsy going through this, because if you go back to 2007, 8, 9, when all these folks were in trouble, it's because they were making way too many cars. Mm-hmm. They weren't making money when they sold them. I mean, how many year-end closeout deals do you hear about now from dealerships? You don't. Because in some respects, by producing too few cars for a couple of years, they've sort of figured out this whole inventory element, the fact where they can sell fewer cars at greater profits.
Yeah,
that's what any company should shoot for. I think they are figuring out. I think it's a positive. So.
I just received the year-end closeout newsletter from Toyota yesterday.
Uh-oh.
Okay.
I mean, they know because all they can. My phone can hear me saying, you know what, maybe it's time to get that Sienna. And it just triggered that email.
There you go.
Like I was finally giving in.
Alexa heard you.
Yeah, that's right.
And David, to John's question, the way I took this was because when that news first came out, it was not from Ford about that they were cutting that production. This is Ford saying, here's what we're doing and here's how it's being managed. I think this is the same cut that initially that was a report that came out of an internal memo or something.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
No, it does make sense. I was just trying to line it up in the limited time I had.
It was confusing. I agree.
Doug says, I think in general, a lot of EV sales also have reached a current saturation point as most of the first movers have been satisfied. Mm-hmm. And we all completely agree. And I feel like not only have the first movers have been satisfied, but I feel like all the undecided have at least picked a lane for the next 5 years. They're just, you know.
Well, and that's sort of one of the, if you want to call it problems or just dynamics of a market. When you make stuff that lasts longer, then the sales cycle is shorter.
For sure. And then the other problem, I think, too, is that like everyone is putting out all this brand new stuff. And the pace of development on battery technology is so fast that year over year, you are getting a dramatically better vehicle. Then people are kind of wait and see, I think, on that as well. Like, do I buy now or do I wait and see what comes out next model year? Do I get 50 more miles of range, you know?
Well, and it's also crazy to think in terms of the product development, having more of a consumer electronic type development cycle. You know, I can't remember who it was that first predicted that cars are going to be more like your phone, your smartphone. It'll be interesting to see if like you have people that turn them over that quick too, just because the new technology in them is moving that fast.
Oh God, I hope not.
No, remember when that first came out and it was just like, there's no way. But we have seen the speed of product development really ramp up.
Oh yeah, yeah.
All right. Our next most popular story, and she's a doozy. Space station blows up real good. Sierra Space is building a modular space station and a full-scale version just past a significant testing milestone. The Life Habitat, which stands for Large Integrated Flexible Environment, is made from woven materials that stay rigid once the environment is inflated. That's right, folks. It's a giant space balloon that you live in. Work in, too. All-inclusive. The company is now testing full-scale 20-foot units that the latest version exceeded NASA's safety standards by 27%. However, due to a leak in the test article, the pressure during the most recent test didn't get high enough to burst Life's bubble. Well, the Sierra Space team was clearly disappointed, but they found the leak, fixed it, and sure enough, if that giant space balloon exploded in incredible fashion, just as our colleague Ben Munson said like 8 or 9 times, kablooey. Sierra says Life is a low-cost way to set up low-Earth orbit operations like microgravity, research, and product development. The company packs Life in a 5-meter rocket fairing, and when it reaches orbit, it inflates to the size of a 3-story apartment building. Additional units can even be connected to it to create a larger living and working environment in space. And in the next few years, Sierra will work on larger designs like a potential 1,400 cubic meter version that can be put into orbit with a single launch. Now, and I know that you love this futuristic tech, right? I know that you love the flying cars. I know that you love the tube technology. So working in a space balloon has got to be right up your alley.
Yeah, the fact that it looks like a bouncy house is a little bit concerning to me, but I know that it's different.
Yeah, much more well-engineered. I mean, was that the aha moment? Some engineer was at like a children's birthday party, saw the bouncy house, and he's like,
Space bouncy house. I mean, just the concept alone of a modular space station is like, makes my brain explode. Yeah, I mean, obviously the stakes are incredibly high on getting this technology right. The test reportedly focused on Life's pressure shell, which is supposed to keep the habitat intact no matter what. As you said, the layer is made up of what they described as Vectron straps, the same material that's used for the Mars rover, which becomes stronger than steel when inflated on orbit, and other high-strength fabrics. added at the end there.
Yeah.
And others.
And others. Yeah. Star. So there are more tests to come, of course. So we may be able to, again, see some cool explosions. This one was quite cool to watch. And you can see the fibers when it explodes. If you haven't watched it, you should watch it. So you can kind of tell that it's more than a bouncy house.
Yeah, it's kind of like watching, like you see those slow-mo high-res videos of like almost like a balloon exploding. And you see the like shreds of the balloon, or not balloon, like a bubble. Mm-hmm. Exploding. I don't know. That's what it reminded me of.
It's more than a bubble.
It's more than a bubble.
To me, like looking at this, because I, you know, your brain moves quickly when you're like, what is this for? Why are we doing it? To me, it'll be interesting to see how the risk reward is calculated on how this would be used. And I mean, like, what types of product development will warrant this? You know, you're sending potentially spacecraft materials, maybe scientists to use this. And so that's what I find interesting is like, how is it going to be evaluated and how is the government going to be involved in like permitting? You know, I mean, somebody's got to say like, this is worth it. And because if we reach the point where it's easy, relatively speaking, to get to space and do research or develop products, then is it always justified and how was that determined? And to me, that's like, wow, that's like a regulatory framework that really has nothing. There's nothing there.
Yeah.
So that would be, I feel like it's going to take some time to get there, not just from this dev side, but also the regulatory framework that will have to be a companion piece to this, whatever effort it would be. But
well, I mean, we've already seen downfalls in regulation when it comes to launching new things into space. When I can't remember what the project was called, what they wouldn't let it back onto Earth.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, they just kind of sent an unregulated craft up there, got away with it. Mm-hmm. And they were coming back down. They're like, hey, no, thanks.
Sorry.
Yeah. Stay up there. You know what I think is the absolute slam dunk application for this specific product?
What do you think it is?
Space dinghy. Like, as attached to international space stations mm-hmm. and other crafts, this would be the perfect sort of emergency vessel that you would attach to those things, could inflate into a livable habitat near immediately when you needed to evacuate.
And then it just like floats out.
I was going to say, but you have no control over where it's going.
Got to work that out, Jeff.
That sounds.
Oh, you're just working on surviving first.
Oh, okay.
I would rather be.
Yeah, I'd rather die immediately than float in space.
Float in space forever. Like
you put a little, some tiny rockets on it that are automatically calibrated to go home. Get as far as.
Oh,
you
that's
can.
It.
Yeah.
Just do that.
Right.
Just do that.
We only have 90 minutes to write this story, Jeff. Yeah, so that's how it works.
Write the script. We'll be in the film.
Just, get off my space dinghy. On the advancements of woven materials, however, one thing that I've been constantly impressed with, Jeff, are how these are moving into industrial applications, right? We've seen HVAC systems that are completely woven materials that are like washing machine washable. And I mean, they're more customizable. They're easier to fit to your facility. So I don't know. At first, I think there's no way this is this makes it into space. But then I see how these have moved into industrial applications already. And I don't know. I remain undecided. Taking a real stance today.
You're all over the place, man. I mean, we should bring you in here last minute all the time.
Yeah.
This has been good.
David is undecided on every story. Yeah. Because
he's waffling.
Yeah.
So the thing that caught my eye is this material, this Vectran stuff. This is amazing. Once it's inflated, this is like 5 times the strength of steel, pound for pound. It's more flexible, lighter weight, less expensive than Kevlar. It is an incredible material. And we do use it for a lot of different stuff. It's used in sails, ropes, all sorts of different stuff. But again, and I do realize Sierra Space is part of the Sierra Nevada Corporation. They're a huge aerospace and military supplier. So I get why this is like their next step in product development. But we have so far to go before we are ready to like put habitats in different places, before this is really a functional lab that could be used for a space station type dynamic. That just seems so many steps down the line. What I wish you would have seen is them come out and say, we want to go there with this. But in the meantime, this incredibly durable, inflatable structure can be used for stuff like temporary military resources, disaster response, mm-hmm. medical outbreaks, things like that need a durable structure to to have people inside of. Mm-hmm. I would have rather have seen that be sort of the first step as opposed to an inflatable space station, or when you look at their website, they're literally looking at more like colonizing and what it's going to mean to have the structure on the moon and Mars and everything else. It's like, we're not even close to that yet. I also can appreciate where they're saying to, you know, to get the space station up there was like however many payloads of equipment and everything else to get it built. This could be quicker. But the thing that also caught me is when it's the size of a 3-story apartment building, but you can only fit 4 people in it. What am I missing there?
Maybe they like high ceilings. You know? I mean, it's just like a, you know, it's a lifestyle thing.
It doesn't seem right now as the most efficient option. And I think the best way to work that out is to not just go for the moon right away, literally.
Yeah.
But develop some real world applications first.
Well, we've already seen a lot of these fabric structures in the industry and being used in like emergency scenarios. I mean, Tesla put up a whole new line in Fremont that was under a fabric building. So, I mean, it's like, I mean, that is happening.
I'm saying this company specifically.
Oh, this company specifically.
This is what they're coming out with. We are using this material for a lot of cool stuff right now. But for them to come out with this first just seemed out of place to me.
So, Jeff, are you saying that this is the thing that should take a few steps back to be another thing?
I'm saying let's make it work here on Earth before we worry about space. Oh. Then it can be the thing here that leads to the thing there.
Good. I'm glad that we really nailed that down. I don't know who contributed that. Was it producer Alex? Thank you very much.
I didn't even see that.
No, it was, I should have just claimed it as my own and fired through.
Just give him some cue cards back there. It might be better.
Hey, Jeff, do you think that this could solve some infrastructure problems on Earth, like bouncy house bridges or something?
I mean, the applications, the potential impact is just immeasurable.
I mean, one thing you mentioned in terms of emergency, like we've seen the emergence of those like the tiny home temporary housing communities. I mean, maybe this is not as cost effective as the resources that it takes to build those, but I could see those being the technology being used for that.
Yeah.
All right. Our most popular story this week. Japanese car maker that faked safety tests sees long wait to reopen factories. The Daihatsu Motor Company skipped mandatory safety tests. They copied data from testing on one side of cars to the other and used timers to ensure airbags went off in tests. No major accidents have been connected to the cheating, but the news has raised serious questions about oversight at Daihatsu, as well as Toyota, its corporate parent. Third-party experts found 174 cases of faked tests affecting dozens of models, including cars sold under the Toyota Motor nameplate. The cheating went back 30 years. Japanese regulators approved 5 of the company's models on Friday, but the company said factories will remain shuttered as it waits on suppliers. The scandal began after a whistleblower came forward last April. Daihatsu, of course, they apologized and they promised sweeping reforms. Hey, we're going to do better, guys. Recalls are likely, possibly totaling more than 300,000 vehicles. Anna, are we still seeing the tip of the iceberg when it comes to how Daihatsu Motor was running things? I mean, when you talk about 30 years of cheating, that 300,000 vehicle number seems a little small.
It does. Like 30 years. And then they're like, sorry, we didn't know we couldn't do that.
Yeah.
Like,
tested one half of the car. The other car's got to be the same.
It's got to be the same.
Of course.
And the airbags did go off.
Yeah.
Because we made them.
It is also like, I mean, this kind of like the emissions cheating scandals that we see. I'm surprised that such a scheme could last so long and be accepted by so many people in a corporate structure. Like there's so much at risk when you do something like this.
Yeah, that's true. I agree with you that there's so much at risk, but I also like the pessimist in me just sees this as like the market just shrugs at the stuff at this point. I mean, there's been so much scandal in automotive over the last, I don't know. Well, it's since it began I don't know. It's frustrating. So like the president of Daihatsu said that the cheating he thought was because of pressure on workers to meet tight deadlines, which to me is like
it comes from the top down, doesn't it?
Well, Yeah, and it's such a lame cop out because
every manufacturer on the planet could say that.
Right. Mm-hmm. And it's been going on for 30 years. So like if for 30 years you're struggling to meet tight deadlines, that's not like a market problem. That is like a you problem, that you're running way too lean or something. You know, that's an oversight problem. Anyway.
Yeah. Or you just know you're going to get away with it.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So Toyota is taking some heat for this from observers, more specifically in Japan right now, I think, about lack of oversight for their global brand. I think they're trying to paint the picture that this is a chronic problem. The article pointed to some other issues that they had had a couple years back with quality. And yet, Toyota and Lexus are consistently top of the list as like most reliable, most trusted brands in automotive. Don't you think if this is going to impact the reputation, it would have last time?
Yeah.
I know that this isn't great for them. I know they're not like excited to deal with this, but at the same time, like, I don't know. I feel like buyers have such short memories and they're like out there to get a deal or they want a specific vehicle and like everybody's corrupt. That is like how, you know, I feel like that's how people absorb this in the end. Like, well, they all do it.
Like the people that don't vote because it's all crooked anyways.
They're all the same. Yeah. But I mean, that's the theme, I think.
Yeah.
And so to me, it's like if enough time passes or it doesn't get enough press coverage or it happens in Japan and not America, American buyers don't care. It's screwed up for what that is. But do they even blink about this? I mean, we talked about Dieselgate recently on the podcast and how many automotive companies, car OEMs, but also component suppliers, Cummins, and, you know, like how many of them were embroiled in this scandal in their own way and how little it's impacted so many of them today. And that wasn't very long ago.
No, I think that's a different comparison because this is a safety issue, whereas that's like a safety issue, but a long-term, you can't breathe anymore because the air is bad issue. You know what I mean?
But do you think people are looking at this and saying, well, they've been doing it for 30 years and nobody's reported a related accident? Do you think buyers in America are looking at this plant in Japan and saying, this is going to stop me from buying a Toyota or a Lexus? They're not.
No, but I do think it might change the perception of buyers in Japan, which is still an incredibly large market. And similar scandals that do happen in the States, I do think that when it is safety related, it really does tarnish the brand. I think it does.
I think you're wrong, David. I think that this will
surprise!
I think it's going to have very little impact. It's really up to Toyota how heavy they want to drop the hammer on Daihatsu. Because when you look at where their leading markets are, yes, it's Japan, Malaysia, Singapore, Africa.
Yeah.
Those are their big markets. It's not the U.S. It's not Europe. With Daihatsu, with these vehicles that we're talking about.
So you don't think it'll change perception for buyers in those areas? I'm not saying American.
I'm saying those areas are not highly regulated enough for this to matter. These car buyers in these geographies are looking for a good deal. They're looking for a low-cost vehicle. And this is just another situation of you could blame it on government oversight. You could say, look, there's never been a problem. I've had this vehicle for how long? What's the big deal? It's less expensive. It does what I need to do. This is the best option for me.
So, you make a good point when it comes to cost, right? Like I was wondering, because they're making these key cars, right? These tiny, inexpensive, nearly disposable cars. Is it because it's that type of car that more people are just like, eh?
But it's also the buyer they're serving, David.
Yeah.
They're just not as conscious or aware of things like safety.
Yeah.
I mean, I would guess for most of those buyers, the individuals who are buying it, they're saying, get me something that gets me from point A to point B as cost effectively, if you want to, or as cheaply as possible. They're not looking at all of those other factors. I'm not saying they shouldn't. I'm not saying that gives Daihatsu some sort of, you know, carte blanche to do what they want to and ignore the safety stuff. I mean, it's actually really repulsive what they did here. Did you look at the details of how they were fixing this test?
Yes.
Basically, they put a piece of plastic in just the vehicles that were being tested to make sure the airbag didn't puncture.
Yeah. It's pretty bad.
I mean,
pretty
ridiculous.
Bad.
And for Toyota to be kind of like, meh, whatever, which is essentially what they did for how long they knew about this. I mean, there's no way they didn't. It should tarnish their brand. It's not going to.
All right. Well, sad all around. I don't know. I disagree, Jeff. I think that I do understand it like in a context of Kia's when they first came out, like when somebody would buy a Kia and something would go wrong, it was just kind of like, well, that's what I get, you know, because I bought a Kia, you know, I bought the low cost option. I don't know. I like to give people more benefit of the doubt where even though they're buying this key car, it's a small car, it's a low cost car, they have a higher expectation in terms of the manufacturing that went into it or just the safety. I mean, does that change their ability to, you know, maybe this is still the only thing they can afford, but I don't know. I think that it definitely plays into the equation.
Okay. But David, like, so the analysts are saying like as a global brand, people may distrust Toyota over this.
Do you
have two Toyotas, right?
Yeah.
This is, you're done buying Toyotas now?
No. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying like, no, that doesn't make me distrust Toyota. What makes me distrust Toyota are the number of recalls that I've received for our hybrid, you know, and the way that their mechanics have gone about fixing those problems in ways that I may or may not agree with. However, I will say compared to other vehicles that I've owned, Toyota still stands above the rest in terms of finding problems, fixing them, and overall like quality and longevity of a vehicle.
So you just did a Toyota commercial.
I mean,
when I asked you if you,
and he were, really is back and forth on this yeah. one.
No, I'm not. I'm saying, okay, if I was going, I wouldn't buy a key car, you know, like,
you can't buy a key car.
I know. I'm not going to go out of my way to buy a key car on Reddit and have it shipped here just to spite you both. But I do.
You, don't think you could even do that.
No.
Challenge me. I'll have it here by next week. No. Don't challenge.
Challenge trolling.
Yeah, you're challenged. Do it. Let's see it.
You're challenged, David.
All right, let's open the doors. It's already here, Jeff. No, I don't know. I
open the doors.
It doesn't. Yeah, well.
The window.
And I guess, no, it doesn't. Like all the, everyone, kind of to the point that you made, like it's weird how so many of these things are getting overlooked by buyers.
Yeah.
But I mean, if this was an American scandal, I guess maybe I would.
It would be completely different.
It would though. Be different. Yeah.
It would. If this was.
If this happened in America. Yeah. Yes. But my point, I guess, is like, it's Toyota who is supposed to be overseeing this. So what does that indicate about their ability to police, you know, what they're putting their badge on? And it doesn't look good, whether it's here or in Japan, but nobody cares because it's not here. Well, nobody here cares that it, you know what I mean? Yeah. That's just how.
But isn't it similar to the Cummins story that we were talking about in like the argument you made where it's on, it seems like it was more on Cummins and not the brands that those engines were going into. Mm-hmm. Like, because this is Daihatsu more than it is Toyota. I guess I disagree with the analyst then. Like, and maybe they're able to kind of like wriggle away from it a little bit because it is a subsidiary.
It's a subsidiary. So Toyota owns it essentially. Yeah, like Stellantis doesn't own Cummins, you know?
Yeah.
So it's a different situation, I think, in that sense, but.
Okay. No, it is not. They just put that it is a snow day tomorrow and you're not getting the same reaction again because there's no way. It's supposed to rain.
There's also no school already tomorrow. So, ha ha.
Are you serious?
Well, at our school, yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. Never mind. You got your reaction.
Different district.
Just like, what? What? All right. Before we jump into, in case you missed it, the stories, you got me sweating on that one. I was just like,
oh, sorry.
the stories that weren't as popular on our websites, but still stand to make a big impact on the industry going forward. We have a word from our sponsor, Limbel. To build a scalable maintenance function, in today's market, organizations need to drive increased output from their equipment and their facilities with fewer resources. But there's one problem. Maintenance 1.0 needs to evolve. So, register to view on-demand Building Your 2024 Maintenance Program. Four key principles to boost uptime now and for the future. You can register now to view it on-demand. Learn which maintenance strategies you can leverage to boost uptime and why software, data, and technology are essential to the future of maintenance. Register now to view it on-demand because it happened 2 hours ago, maybe three.
And now you can demand it.
Yeah. Now you can just, you can watch it whenever.
Yeah.
You know? All right. In case you missed it, stories maybe not as popular on their websites, but still stand to make a big impact on the industry going forward. Anna, what do you have for us this week?
I selected a video this week that you put together about the Apple Car.
thanks. You don't say. Thanks for the support.
Yeah, no problem. And guess what, guys? Mm. The Apple Car is delayed again.
Shocking. Shocking development.
So crazy. So, rumors have swirled ever since Apple's Project Titan car project leaked, leading people to speculate just as to what Apple is doing. Since then, the car's mythic rise has been fueled by only speculation, basically. Very little evidence of progress. The planned launch for the fully self-driving EV was pushed back several times until 2022, when it was said to be slated for 4 years down the road. At the time, the company also cut Level 5 full self-driving from its autonomous ambitions. A new report from Bloomberg suggests that Apple is delaying the car's launch another 2 years to 2028 and scaling its self-driving down to Level 2 plus autonomy. Mm-hmm. With Level 5, the car can drive itself with no human intervention. In Level 2, the car offers some steering and brake acceleration support, like keeping you in the lane and adaptive cruise control.
Groundbreaking technology.
So exciting. I cannot wait to see this hit the road.
What's it going
to
be like?
I've never seen that before. So according to people close to the project who spoke with Bloomberg, the 2028 mark is the earliest we might see the car. The project has seen some turnover with leadership changes. You described it as a make or break moment, potentially, especially if the car is going to debut with tech that we've already seen.
Yeah, and is already old now. So
right.
What's it going to be in 2 years? Oh, wait, 4 years.
2028. Yeah. So I don't know about make or break. I think it's already broken, maybe. and while Apple kicks the can down the road, unfortunately, they just increase their competitive pressures. But the good news, I think, is that many in automotive, or at least a handful, have kind of put the brakes on development of autonomous vehicles at this time. Mm-hmm. You saw it with GM taking a break with testing. Tesla's kind of taking a breather. Besides Mercedes-Benz, who I think is like the only auto company that's like made any development progress in the last year.
Okay.
I think the reality is that many of them have bigger fish to fry, but so does Apple, and it's not an automotive. Like maybe this is a hot take, but I doubt it at this point. Stop it. Like no one needs the Apple car. We don't need you to do that. You're Apple. You got plenty to do. You got plenty on your plate. No need to pursue this. Just, put a fork in it. It's just not necessary.
I mean, not necessary. That was the argument against Apple TV, and now we have Ted Lasso, and the world was changed forever.
What?
You know, I don't know. It's one thing that
I like Ted Lasso too, but like a network for it. I mean, like not that wasn't necessary either.
One thing that is crazy about this entire thing is, I mean, maybe this winds up being the longest term guerrilla marketing campaign ever, because it has been fueled and maintained by speculation only.
That's all it is.
And the one thing that I kind of thought about was, what if, I mean, Apple has done a great job at coming up with not necessarily a revolutionary product, but a revolutionary design and a revolutionary way to sell it. So if they can come out with an Apple car that is still the exact same as what's on the market, I have a feeling that they'll be able to, you know, maybe sell it and market better. I don't know what that's going to look like when it comes out. Right now, where it stands, it seems like they're only falling further behind. So I don't see that. But that's the only thing, is that my entire life have discounted Apple's marketing savvy. Mm-hmm. And if they could do this to a car, maybe it'll work. But, you know, also maybe it'll be like, what, an e-machine?
Well, and to your point, like maybe, you know, it's guerrilla marketing to the point where like they're just trying to show that they are capable of doing it and that they have the tech and the design chops to do so. Mm. But if they put something out that sucks, it's going to be terrible.
Oh, yeah.
And really expensive and sucks. Like, just don't do it. But maybe they're not planning to do it. You know, they're just like playing ball out there and just like having fun and seeing what people will talk about.
Yeah, keeping that Apple name out there.
Yeah.
But I mean, then you go back to that whole hundreds of millions of dollars in development, Jeff. And
but do we know that for sure?
Do we know that for sure?
Well, I guess no, we don't know anything for sure. The only thing we know for sure is that some executives who have worked on the Apple Car project, which had like, I can't remember what his pedigree was. He was from Tesla and then he went to Apple. And I believe he's at Ford now. Other than that, that's I kind of already know is that people have worked on the project.
Yeah, I can never see this coming to fruition. Number one, I think Apple's too smart. Because as we've discussed before, making cars is hard.
It's hard.
It is not easy. And they are already a tier one supplier. I mean, there's Apple CarPlay. They've already been involved. If they ever want to get into all these subscription-based services, who better to facilitate than Apple? Mm-hmm. So I think they've already got inroads into automotive. So I think maybe this is part of just either some sort of marketing campaign or some way to keep them at the forefront of these conversations within the automotive sector. That's the only thing I can think of because this makes no logical sense from a product development perspective.
Jack says, hashtag believe. You keep on believing, Jack.
Jack, you want this car?
That's a Ted Lasso thing.
And John.
You just want Apple TV. Okay, fine. That's already here.
It comes, you know what? That's one of the key features of the new Apple car is the infotainment system comes with a subscription to Apple TV.
Is that true?
Should be the differentiator. I feel like we're a little early in the process. Just like they're already working on the features they can sell. John wants to know if it charges using an iPhone charger. Probably not, but you actually, just think about the charging technology. What's the one thing that we think of with Apple products? It's closed off tech, right? And so when we talk about charging technology, everyone playing nice with that Apple or the Tesla charger, all of a sudden Apple's going to come out and have its own proprietary tech. I don't know.
Why would they do that?
Because they're Apple. That's what they would do.
Yeah, I just,
everything
these are
closed system.
Everything about it is a bad idea.
We look forward to it. Actually, and I mentioned it in the video. One thing I have liked about it is the rampant speculation. And it's given all these industrial designers to kind of just guess.
I know.
You know, and they come up with renderings. The one that I talked about was the design that came out, I believe it's like Vanarama, where they went back and took all of Apple's current patents and use those patents and applied them to the design of a car. And I was just like, okay, it's cool. If anything, it's working as a good prompt for design students across the world. Doug wants USB-C now.
Oh.
Everyone stands with you, Doug. Hashtag believe. Jeff, you're in case you missed it this week.
Yeah, it'd be kind of a unique sort of interesting story here. Talking about crop scientists and educators are developing a popcorn-based curriculum.
Ooh.
So, you know, we talk a lot about STEM needs. We talk about skills gap and all that. Well, maybe this is a way to help solve some of those issues. With a funding from a new USDA grant, the University of Illinois Chicago, or, you know, University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, excuse me, has a crop scientist and collaborating educators that are developing a popcorn-based curriculum. They're going to use popcorn to reinforce concepts around agricultural science, AI, biotech, computer science, genomics, research, and other stuff for basically high school and even middle school type of students. Right now, they've got a guy, Tony Studer. He is a professor from the University of Illinois, and he's talking about the reason that he's justifying this curriculum is he's saying everybody knows popcorn, but students don't typically think about it when it comes to how science is used to improve the food we eat. I'll spit it out eventually
We'll get there. Sorry, I've infected you.
He said they're going to use popcorn to scaffold more complex science concepts to keep students more engaged because it's already something they're familiar with. And the article goes into a lot of different examples of how they'll use kernel selection or why did the popcorn basically produce in a different way based on the environmental impacts. Some of the different ways it was stored, produced. We can get into soil management, using AI predictive models to see how well it's going to produce or how they could reinforce or improve the production model to get a better yield.
Yeah.
I love this because I've always been the type of person who prefers show me instead of tell me when it comes to learning how to do something. So we want to get more kids involved in STEM. We want to get more kids filling these industrial engineering roles. This is how we set them up and getting them more engaged, as opposed to giving them a textbook and some lectures and take some notes. Here we've got a real world application using stuff that's not super heavy or server complex, but still can embed all of these unique models to give them a foundation from which to grow on. Now, maybe, you know, 80% of the kids that go into this class are kind of like, meh, whatever, I'm still going to do what I'm going to do. But if we can just pick a couple more of those kids up who are going to do something else, and it leads them more towards a STEM career path, I think it's pretty cool.
No, are you going to go back to school to major in popomics or popomics, as they call it?
I mean, there was a better chance of me getting involved in math and science if it was with this type of curriculum than a lot of the more traditional approaches, I would say.
No, I'm constantly intrigued with these exciting and kind of experimental curriculums that come out.
Yeah.
I think that there's a lot of room to grow in terms of how you can connect with different students, especially with something that's a little bit more hands-on. When I went to that SAP conference, and I know I talked about it on the podcast, but it really opened my eyes to how AI and technology is being applied in the agricultural sector. So I do think you're right. This is a great opportunity to kind of really get kids involved on the ground floor and give them a better understanding. It's like, I mean, it's like my kid who is in kindergarten was talking to me about coding yesterday. And I'm like, excuse me? And he's like, no, I'm coding. My friend and I, my coding partner. I'm like, you have a coding partner? And he's like, yeah, we have to code the mouse so that way it gets the cheese through the maze. And I'm like, oh my God, you're already better at coding.
You've done, yeah.
Yeah. So I think it's incredible what they're doing with curriculum and trying to keep up with new technology. Anna, your thoughts on a popcorn-based curriculum?
Yeah, well, first of all, this really got to me in terms of like how little I know about the difference between corn and popcorn. So I'll have to do some.
There really? You go.
Yeah.
No kernels. No two kernels are alike.
What?
Yeah.
Like snowflakes.
I don't. What?
Yeah. I mean, just like a base knowledge of popping corn. You have to know that.
I don't.
Oh, right.
You
need to pop more corn.
Yeah, I guess. Anyway, I agree. It's so cool. It's cool that they're targeting 4-H students with this, but then like the AI component is like, you know, that's completely different curriculum than what they're used to. Yeah. So will be interesting to see if this takes off because it's open source. So cool, exciting things always from education.
Well, my In Case You Missed It this week is a touch of a doozy. So I apologize and look forward to both your takes on this story. It's about a Brazilian billionaire who sells a tech company to fund an EV startup. All right, guys, tell me if this sounds familiar. Flavio Figueiredo Assis is an entrepreneur who wants to make history with the first Brazilian-made electric car. Assis hopes, or I think it's Athis, is the founder of Lacard, a food card administrator that reached yearly total sales of $1 billion. In 2022, he sold the company to create Lacar, Brazil's first electric car manufacturer. Lacar currently employs a team of 30 engineers, and many of them have a great pedigree, Ford, Toyota, Nissan. They're building a factory that's going to be set up in the southeastern region of the country. The Lacar 459 is the company's first vehicle. It's going to have batteries sourced from Winston Battery, which also supplies VW and Hyundai. And the manufacturer's suggested retail price is expected to be $55,000 with a range of around 250 miles per charge. They also have plan an urban version, the Lacar Pop, that's going to have an estimated price of $20,000 and a 155 mile range per charge. It's also going to have a capacity for 5 passengers. The company is privately held, but the expectation is to go public by 2025. And Athis's planned investment is $3 billion. If all goes according to plan, the first vehicles will be manufactured in December. In 2025, the company hopes to produce 300 cars per month with revenues of $200 million. And in 5 years, the car intends to produce 50,000 vehicles annually with $15 billion in revenue. Anna, does this story sound familiar?
If all goes according to plan.
Who does he want to be?
Well, he wants to be Elon Musk. He said that, right?
Yes, he wants to be Elon Musk. And I don't know. I just feel like that alone is a bit of a moonshot.
I agree. I don't think we need any more EV startups anywhere. Brazil has plenty of auto plants already.
Yeah.
Latin America has plenty of auto plants. It's not like they can't get cars without building their own.
True. Well, and this is
they're already doing that. So,
well, and at 50,000 vehicles annually, $15 billion in revenue, you know, the numbers work out. It's going to be an expensive car. Mm-hmm. It's going to be an expensive car. Who knows what they're going to. So the numbers don't really check out in terms of it being a $55,000 car. And yet still making $15 billion in revenue, selling $50,000 a year.
Right.
But I don't know. I chose this story, first of all, because It's very brash. He's trying to make a splash. And I mean, I get it. You want to try and bring domestic EV manufacturing to Brazil. I think that's a noble effort. I just think maybe it's a bit of a fool's errand. Jeff, your thoughts on Flavio's aspirations to be the next Elon Musk?
Well, first of all, shoot your shot. I mean, yeah. he's been successful before. Go for it. I can't blame him for thinking that. I think his business model here is a bit, I think it's too wide. Quite honestly, I mean, focus on a category and go there. I think that's the best way to break into a market. I think when he looks at these vehicles that are around the $20,000 mark, I think there might be an opportunity there.
Yeah.
When you start getting higher than that, I know the thought is, well, then I don't have to sell as many because they cost more.
Yeah.
However, that becomes a more select customer, more customer services oriented. They want more bells and whistles, more features and benefits, financing. All of those things may come into play at a higher level when you look at a lower tier, lower priced vehicle. So that's where I think there might be an opportunity there if that was his focus. But when you just want to launch an entire like sort of line of vehicles right from the start, yeah, there's so much competition out there, especially when you've said we're coming. Yeah. It's not like we're here and here we go. Mm-hmm. It's like, hey, we're going to be there in a couple of years. So watch out. They're going to be ready for you.
Well, and it just, you know, at first when I was looking at this, it definitely seemed like just a PR play. But I mean, he has potentially a lot of skin in the game of his own money. He's sending the prototype off for testing to be approved for manufacturability and to pass safety and emissions testing, stuff like that. So he's going through the paces. And one thing I didn't share is that he does have like an interesting business model in terms of kind of making a new hybrid 3-year lease subscription model as to how people could potentially have access to these cars. So there might be something there. I don't know. I just chose it because to your point, Anna, we have a lot of EV startups already, but that doesn't seem to stop people from thinking they have the next greatest idea.
No, it doesn't. But is there a need? You know, like, is he wants to do this because he wants it to be Brazilian made again? Yeah. Noble, cool. Maybe you'll get some people that way. But is there a need?
Yeah.
And if there isn't, then why? Then it's not a good business model.
Doug says poor name choice, as some of the older folks might remember Renault's Le Car. And John says he wants to be Elon Musconi. All right.
All right.
Well, let's move into our final thoughts before we get out of here this week. Anna, what is your final thought?
I just wanted to let you guys know that every year around this time, I like make a note to look for what day the sun stays out until 5 p.m. again. And today's the day.
Oh, really?
Yep.
I thought we passed that, Mark. That's great. Mm-hmm.
Today is it. So I just want you guys to enjoy that. Mm-hmm. And it's just going to get better from here. So
it will. Well, I mean, it helps, you know, the weather broke a little bit. And it's amazing how you can go from negative 30 to 30 degrees Fahrenheit. And you, all of a sudden, you don't need a jacket.
No, I'm not wearing my hat or anything. Like, I just am like, this feels great. And then, but like, there's such a weird, it's weird how that works. Like the beginning of fall and winter when you're like freezing when it's 30.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Then in springtime,
yeah,
it's like 35 and you're like, let's get our shorts out and start barbecuing.
Yeah, you're why like is that hardened to it.
Mm-hmm.
My final thought is that, Anna, your final thought last week actually inspired us about, or I believe it was last week, about the board games.
Mm-hmm.
And just the mere mention of that, we've played a lot of board games as a family this week. You know, last night we had the Pop-O-Matic bubble out. And while nice. It is difficult to get through an entire game of Trouble, especially with a 3-year-old and a Pop-O-Matic bubble, you know, it was a good reminder of how you can kind of just sit around and connect as a family.
Mm-hmm.
And really get some quality time.
Like, and fight and argue.
Yeah, I mean, of course, like then one starts crying, one Adele takes that one, and then, you know, mom and Des finish the game. But either way, it was fun until it lasted. So just
it's fun until it lasted.
Or as fun, it was fun as long as it lasted.
There you go.
There we go. While it lasted. Let's get out of here. No, but just a reminder to everybody that it's okay to just, you know, take a minute and enjoy your family. Jeff. Was that, is that radical or is it, did I say it? Did I do it? Did I stroke out again?
No, you're good.
Oh, okay.
You're good.
Jeff, you're in case you missed it. Is your final thought?
We're just going to get out of here. I just wanted to thank, Chuck Marin, our East Coast salesperson, and Noel, Noel. Nolan Bielstein, our editor who put together our football pool, because thanks to the weird rules that they put together, I think I'm in pretty good shape to win it. Even though my first draw was the Packers, which was great, so I could root for them. Because after they beat the Cowboys, somebody else on this panel had. Yeah. But then they covered the spread, so I get to swap the Packers for the Niners, and I think they're in pretty good shape to win the whole thing. So thanks to those guys for putting a couple extra bucks in my pocket. I'm just going to claim that already.
It was an interesting way to do a playoff pool
where
you get a team and then you can steal a team if they don't cover the spread. It was also interesting how everyone in the office immediately bought in when Nolan said, it costs this. If it looks difficult, don't worry. Just give me your money and I'll take care of it. And everyone's like, in!
Yeah, that's true. We trust Nolan too much.
And he somehow fixed it where he still didn't win.
But I did thank him after we went through our board game collection, the ones I did give him, the Family Feud Home Edition.
Yeah, that's a good thank you gift.
He's a man of the trivia.
Yes. Survey says.
All right. Well, survey says we need to get out of here. I'm struggling. Jack says, great show again, y'all. Thanks for the enjoyable content. Did you miss the last 5 minutes, Jack? I'm sorry about those. All right. Well, before we get out of here, please make sure to like, share, and subscribe to the podcast. You can also help us out a lot by leaving the podcast a positive review on whatever platform you use. If you want to email the podcast, you can reach any of us at Jeff, David, or Anna at IAN.com with email the podcast in the subject line. You can also subscribe to our daily newsletter. Get it delivered to your inbox first and subscribe to us on YouTube so you can join us live every Friday and help mix it up with John, Doug, Jack, and whoever joins us live every Thursday. All right, for Jeff Franke and Anna Wells, I'm David Manti. This is the Today in Manufacturing podcast, and we'll see you next week.